Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccessRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on trends in cybersecurity for the ARM industry. A recent data breach at the collection agency has focused a spotlight on the cybersecurity practices of companies in the credit collection industry. And while cybersecurity has always been an important topic, having effective policies and procedures in place is now even more so. Today, you're going to hear from a number of cybersecurity experts, and you'll get the chance to learn about the latest trends in cybersecurity and how better to protect yourself from threats inside and outside of your company. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Cornerstone Support. You get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. David Sherman is a partner in the Philadelphia office of Lewis Brisbois. He counsels clients across business sectors on commercially reasonable data privacy and information security practices. Before an information security incident occurs, David facilitates incident response planning and risk assessment to enhance enterprise security posture and mitigate potential exposure. David assesses clients' existing service provider agreements to evaluate and optimize contractual allocation of risks, rights, and obligations set forth in provisions that may give rise to exposure in the event of a data security incident. He holds a certified information privacy professional credential. Dorothea Weston is the divisional president of Capital Special Risks, a division of Specialty Program Groups, LLC, a company she's worked at since 1992. A certified risk manager and certified insurance counselor, Dorothea manages a team of 15 professionals. In 2017, she was named a rare spirit in the insurance industry for running and owning a successful all-female professional and management liability niche brokerage shop. Since 2007, Ben Johnson has served as the director of risk management for Cornerstone Support. He specializes in business insurance for collection agencies, debt buyers, and collection attorneys. He lives in Woodstock, Georgia with his wife and twin daughters. Cornerstone Support is a premier provider of insurance and state licensing services for the accounts receivable management industry. Since 1988, the company has assisted thousands of collection agencies, debt buyers, and collection law firms with their risk management needs. Cornerstone's clients are located in all 50 states and around the globe, and the company is based in the Atlanta suburb of Roswell, Georgia. Today, you're going to get a presentation from Ben, David, and Dorothea, and we encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll do our best to get to as many of them as possible. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, before we begin today's presentation, I wanted to ask everyone to take a minute in advance and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and finding the speakers like the ones we have today who are the people you want to hear from. With that, let me turn the microphone over to Ben Johnson to begin today's presentation. Ben?
Thanks, Mike, for having us again. Glad to be here. Just a little background. I had attended the National Creditors Bar conference a couple of months back where David Sherman was presenting with some colleagues from his firm, and he put together really a nice presentation on cybersecurity trends. And so he was somebody that I wanted to loop in on this presentation as well. Dorothea Weston is an insurance broker that I've worked with for many years, and you won't find anyone anywhere who knows more about cyber liability insurance, and that is obviously something that is constantly evolving. So I wanted to get her on the call as well. And I think what we'll do is have David run through some slides here about cybersecurity, about trends that may impact the ARM industry, and maybe some best practices, and then we'll pivot a little bit to Dorothea and just get some thoughts from her about what to look for in these coverages. They're all different. You know, what do we need to do to try to protect ourselves in the event of a breach? And so with that, David, I think we'll go ahead and get to you and discuss some trends in cybersecurity.
All right. Well, Mike, Ben, thanks so much for the kind introduction and for having me on today's presentation. It's a pleasure to be here. Before we start diving immediately into trends, just a little bit more about my background and what informs my experience, in addition to all of the proactive work that, Mike, thank you again for laying out, to help clients prepare for and prevent, hopefully, data security incidents and work to improve their overall information security posture. I've also, for better or worse, had the pleasure of working with hundreds of clients over the last few years in responding to data breaches of all shapes and size in the ARM industry and otherwise. And I've defended over 25 data breach class actions. So for better or worse, I should also mention that my team is, I think we're on pace this year to respond to 1,200 data security incidents. So for better or worse, we've seen quite a bit, and we really do have our finger on the pulse of what the attackers are doing, what we're seeing, and how to best respond. So with that, you know, again, with the goal, as Mike mentioned, of providing a few just, you know, real, can we give you a couple concrete takeaways? I think one trend, one concept that we really need to embrace from the outset is that across, you know, information security statutes, across, you know, whether it's under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, under FCRA, any of the state information security statutes, or any implementing regulations, you know, anything that we need to consider, or GDPR in Europe, or PIPEDA in Canada, a fundamental theme is that we need to understand the technology that we are using, right? And I don't think, and I don't mean to imply that we need, you know, computer science degrees from MIT to understand how encryption works or anything like that. But rather, you know, if you think back to the time before everything was in the cloud or before records were, you know, readily available to all employees on a shared server, you know, if you were in a collection agency and you were opening a new office 30, 35 years ago, and you were looking for a new space, right, you'd want to think about, and let's say that you had 10,000 hard copy credit files in your possession, and those were documents that you regularly stored and managed. If you were looking for a new office, you'd be looking for a facility that was secure, right? You'd want to check out, and you might not be actively thinking about it, but you'd be trying to figure out, okay, do we have a security guard at the door? How are the locks? Do the place seem secure? Are there closed caption cameras, you know, within reasonable view in the space itself? If you're buying new, you know, new furniture, are you using open shelves or are you using, you know, secured locked file cabinets to keep those records safe? So all I'm saying is that the same concepts, right, these basic tenets of how are we keeping the information we have, those crown jewels, safe, you know, it's no different in, you know, in a shared file, in a cloud storage facility, in your email account. You know, our goal here is to understand how we're taking information in, how sensitive that information is, right? How much protection do we really or should we need to apply to it when it's, you know, coming in, when it's stored, or when we're transferring it out via email, via file transfer, or otherwise. So we just want to keep that in mind, right? We need to understand the basics, not in depth, but just, you know, at a high level. How are we processing this information? How are we storing this information? And how are we sending it out? Because without an understanding of those fundamentals, it wouldn't be possible for us to then say, okay, well, how do we protect what could be some loopholes or some open ends in our security posture, whether it's in a server, whether it's in file transfer, whether it's in an email environment, et cetera. So with that, over the last 6 to 8 months, we've seen by far the largest uptick in social engineering-based attacks. I think in the slide it's referenced as the largest attack vector, by far the most prevalent. I'm sure the majority of you have heard social engineering. It's a big buzz term nowadays. But even if there's one person out there who hasn't heard it, I'll generally describe it as a strategy that attackers can use to try and step into the shoes of somebody who we know and trust to facilitate a fraudulent act of some sort, right? So there are a variety of ways it happens. You know, 10 years ago, attackers used to, you know, send out the quintessential phishing email to a whole bunch of people, and the subject line would be, congrats, you hit lotto, you've won 10 million bucks, right? And in the body of the email itself, it would say something like, congratulations, please respond with your name, your social security number, your address, and all that same information for your spouse, and we'll mail you a check in 2 weeks. And I don't mean to be glib about it, but, you know, the attackers have become a lot more sophisticated in recent years. Now, all of a sudden, you'll see an attacker send an email to all members of an organization. Let's say your company has, you know, 100 people, right? All 100 will receive a message from an email address that looks, you know, pretty close to something like Microsoft, right? It might not be perfect, but unless you're scrutinizing it pretty closely, it's going to, you know, it's passable. And the body of the message is going to look pretty on point. Again, might not be 100% perfect, but unless you're stopping and slowing down and thinking about it, if the body of that message says, you know, hello from Microsoft, we're working to reset passwords to improve the overall security posture of your organization, please click the following link, enter your credentials so that we can reset your password or something like that. You know, it's plausible, and people click on it and people provide their credentials, and then sure enough, you know, the fraudulent actor, the bad actor has access to 1, 2, 20 accounts in your network, to credentials to get into those accounts. And there are a variety of ways in which the attackers use that access, right, to monetize data that they may have access to through those accounts. One of which is by just generally gathering up all the credentials that they were able to get, bundling them and putting them up for sale on the dark web, which is something we'll talk about in a little bit, right, so that they can just sell them to the next threat actor. But the other way is through, again, this concept of social engineering, right? They're sometimes attackers sit there, they get into let's say the CFO of an organization's account, and they camp out and they watch for whether it's hours or a few days so that they can create essentially a mental map of an organization, right? Who's, you know, who are the key points of contact in HR or with accounts receivable or collections or what have you, you know, the folks in your organization who are going to have access to sensitive data so that they can step in and try to facilitate fraud. So for instance, you know, we commonly see these days all sorts of redirects, fraudulent redirects, whether it's a wire transfer redirect, let's say, for instance, you know, the attacker is in the CFO's inbox for a few days and he's monitoring traffic and he figures out that Jane Doe is the AR manager and they start watching and we know that a big receivable is due from a client, you know, on next Wednesday, right? So what the attacker is going to do is step in and then somehow convince Jane Doe through perhaps another email from a similar organization that they should be sending out that the payment that they're expecting should come in from to a different bank account, a new bank account, right? So the attacker would send out and say, "Hey, client, you know, the payment that you owe should go to this new bank account. Please wire funds no later than the date due." And sure enough, next Wednesday rolls around, and your organization isn't seeing the payment. Right? It went somewhere else and we're in the dark for a couple of days. So you reach out to the client and you say, "Hey client, what's going on here?" And the client says, "Well, I paid it." And then sure enough, here you are and there's nothing to do. So that's certainly one way in which we commonly see attackers try to monetize access to an email account. Another is through, for instance, access to or attempts to redirect direct deposit payments, right? So let's say the CFO's account is compromised. The attacker, you know, inputs some rules into the account to mask their activity and reaches out to the HR person and says, "HR person, I need you to give me credentials to access the payroll system. Some of our folks want to change their direct deposit information." So the email looking legitimate coming from the CFO to the HR person, the HR person sends back credentials for the payroll portal so that they can make the changes or, you know, the input data that may be provided to the HR person. And sure enough, the next thing you know, payroll comes around and half your employees didn't receive their paychecks. Sometimes they notice instantaneously. Also, surprisingly, sometimes it takes a few weeks for folks to find out. So those are all ways in which, you know, again, attackers try and step into the shoes of a known or trusted person to facilitate fraud. Another common, really common trend, especially around tax season, is what's referred to as the W-2 image exploit. So meaning, you know, the CFO's inbox is compromised, right? Same general fact pattern emerges and he reaches out to the HR person and says, "I'm working on a report. I need all the W-2s for our employees in 2018. And sure enough, he receives them because the HR person, you know, thinks, "Hey, it looks legitimate. It's coming from the right account. Okay." And then sure enough, you have all tax and wage information, social security numbers, and all sorts of other sensitive information for all your employees that could be compromised or out there in the open. And again, the same concept holds true, whether it's for client data, you know, if you're looking at, you know, a collections file and you have name, socials, and account info for, you know, 200, 2,000, or 5,000, you know, individuals from whom you're trying to collect, same concept applies. Attackers can go after it that way too, if they're savvy enough. So that's the general gist of email compromise and trends. But the good news there is that things aren't quite as scary as they seem. And there are a number of really, I'll call them low-hanging fruit techniques that we can rely on to try and mitigate some of that risk or some of that exposure, right? The first and foremost, it's training. It's about making sure our employees and our personnel understand the risks. Can we look for emails that just seem off, right? Like that initial phishing email from Microsoft, for instance, right? Why would Microsoft be reaching out to us to try and reset our password? Isn't that something that our IT team or our managed service provider ordinarily do? And if you have questions about it because it just doesn't seem right, we should teach our people to pick up the phone, you know, reach out to the IT team that we have on staff, reach out to management. Always better to ask. And the same concept holds true, right, for something like a request for W-2s or a request for payroll records or a request for, you know, to change wire transfer information, right? All we have to do is pick up the phone, call the person and say, hey, this may seem a little silly. I'm sorry to bother you. But before I, you know, hit go on this, before I facilitate the transfer or change this information, would you mind just confirming for me that this is actually you and that I should be doing this? And by and large, those practices, silly as they may seem right now, are becoming commonplace, and they really are a best practice. So again, using that human firewall, right, using that second factor of just, you know, a double check from a trusted person, whether it's on the phone, knocking on their door, sending them a text, you know, any of those ways, just having that second layer of security can go a long way towards towards preventing some really unfortunate activity.
David, Ben here, as we move on to the next slide, just talking about collection agencies being targets. One of the frequent questions that I hear as I'm talking with collectors out at conferences, why would they want to target us? You know, the folks that we store on our server have bad credit. What do you typically say to a question like that as we're looking at the next slide as we've got compromised data and collection agencies becoming targets?
Yeah, Ben, that's a fantastic question and a great point. At the end of the day, we're all, the simple answer is we're all kind of soft targets, right? Not to mention, even though on a daily basis, we're, you know, especially in the ARM industry, you know, you guys are processing data for less than ideal and, you know, potential consumers of credit, right? Yeah, their credit scores may be terrible. It may be not the right fit, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a trove of valuable data that the attacker can access, right? First and foremost, as I was mentioning earlier, right? There's employee data, right? There are vendor invoices that are coming in left and right, or client, you know, if you sub out work to agencies for collections purposes, right? And there are huge payments that are due and owed. You know, there are all those other vendors, client relationships, outstanding receivables that can be redirected. Certainly employee payroll data can be redirected. All sorts of employee information can be used to facilitate fraud. Also, you know, if you think about just the way we use email on a daily basis, whether it's, and I'm, me too, you know, we're all guilty of it. We all use our email for personal purposes as well, right? We all, you know, have to process a mortgage refinance application, you name it. And it's just sometimes easier to get it done while you have your work email open on your screen than to go into your personal account or use a secured portal. You know, life happens. People don't always have the luxury of doing the right thing. So our email accounts are kind of a trove of information, right? So even if they're for, debtors who have poor credit, even still, an attacker can get a hold of an Excel sheet with, you know, the names and socials for 5,000 debtors and put that up for sale on the dark web or pass it off to his buddy or open credit cards, and someone's going to get a hit, right? Just because somebody has one debt doesn't mean they have 15 or 20 or 25. You name it, you know, sometimes they can monetize it, or they can just try to, you know, sell it wholesale in a cash, as I said, sort of on an eBay, what I'll call an eBay for bad things on the dark web. And Keith, thank you for pulling up that slide. You know, the dark web's a forum where you can sell and engage in all sorts of nefarious activity, but they really do have forums that, you know, are essentially like eBay, except for, you know, instead of buying antiques or products, you're looking at drugs or weapons or, say, social security numbers for people who, for, you know, 500 people who live within 5 miles of zip code 10005, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be sort of a numbers game for these guys where they don't really care whether the consumer has good credit or not. They just want to get a million social security numbers and sell them for whatever they can get on the dark web, and then move on to the next one. And that still leaves you with, you know, the cost of cleanup and notification. So.
Exactly. And it's not just, yeah, it's not just socials, it's account credentials too, right? If you have an organization, as I said, with 100 email users and, you know, 20 folks in the organization click on that, you know, link from fake Microsoft and compromise their credentials, right? The attackers also put up gigantic troves of, you know, email account credentials for 20 users at acnecorp.com and sell that too. You know, there's a way to monetize all that data on the dark web, or they can attempt to do things themselves, right? Just by mining those accounts, getting into those accounts and running search terms for personal information or for credit card numbers or for social security numbers, et cetera. So, you know, there are all sorts of ways in which data can be monetized, you know, just by virtue of access, and the attackers are pretty darn creative in how they go about it. So I think that covers email compromise. The other big trend that we're seeing these days, Keith, if you want to jump back to the extortion of the tax slide. Are what's referred to as extortion of the tax. And the big buzzword of the day is ransomware, right? I'm sure, again, just about everyone on the call has heard it, but for if anyone hasn't, ransomware is a kind of virus that completely encrypts infected systems. So imagine that you show up to work, you know, we just had the 4th of July, right, which is for better or worse, major holidays are a prime time for attackers to engage in all sorts of nefarious activity. So you show up, it's the Monday after the long weekend, and you open up your computer and you try to log in, and everything, your computer is what we call a brick. It's just utterly useless. It is locked down. You can't access it. You can't do anything. You try to log into your email account through the web. You can't do it. Completely down. Everything is just gibberish and makes no sense. And the only thing that you see on your desktop is, you know, a notepad file, right? And you open it up and it says, greetings, happy 4th of July. You've been the victim of a ransomware attack. If you'd like your data to be decrypted, please either reach out to email XYZ, and it's usually a temporary email account, within 5 days or whatever time frame may be. And you may purchase a decryption key, and sometimes the node will provide a demand of, you know, it's usually in cryptocurrency, of say 5 Bitcoin within 72 hours or 5 days or 10 days, or your data will be deleted. And in fact, just yesterday I saw a ransom note for an affected client that had a smiley face emoji to conclude the message, as polite as they were on that. So you're left with a choice. Well, my goodness, my network is down. I can't do anything. My file servers are encrypted. My email is encrypted. All the desktops in my network are useless. We can't get any work done. What on earth do I do? The first question is, well, I'd sincerely hope that you call your insurance broker, and I'll let Dorothea talk about that a bit later on, and call your, I'd hope you'd call me or you know, your attorney. And the first questions we'd ask you are, well, do you have any viable backups? And you'd say, hopefully, yes, or, you know, yes, something exists, or no, the attackers encrypted all my backups. And I'd say, well, do you have an off-site backup? Do you have something that was saved to a hard drive that you pulled, you know, that you pulled offline and you put in a safe in your office or something like that? And if you say yes, then we'd say, wonderful, let's get you restored. This is really frustrating, but we'll have you back up and running shortly. And if not, then we're left with a little bit of a choice. The question is, well, how much data was encrypted? What's the value of that data? And what do we do to try and get you back up online? Do we need to contemplate paying purchasing the decryption key from the threat actors and paying that ransom demand? And our approach to it generally is that it's a business decision. You know, we try to be judgment-free and say, look, either you do or you don't. Let's talk about the ups and downs. A lot of the times the answer there depends on how adequate your insurance coverage is as well. But the question is, what do you need to do? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say,
David, I'd like to add, I'm sorry, Ben. This is Dorothea. I'd like to add that we're seeing even sneakier attacks where they'll lay in wait. They'll lay the software out there to encrypt, but they'll wait 6 months to even a year for large corporations, and they'll just hold it out there, and then they'll run it. So even your backups are rendered useless. Unless you've taken your data offline on a regular basis and put it in what IT guys call dead storage, meaning you make a backup and you pull it off, you cannot access it. But even some of those, if they're laying in wait for up to that year time period we've seen, that offline data may be useless as well, because it's set to trigger at a certain time period in the future. And if it recognizes that date, that data then becomes encrypted. So the criminals are extremely...
I was if someone did pay the ransom, would that not then potentially, I mean, again, as David said, it's a business decision, but could it potentially put a target on your back for future attacks because now they know they've got somebody who's willing to pay?
Well, to that, if you're working with your insurance provider, if you've purchased the coverage to assist you, they're going to, if you need to pay the ransom to get your data unencrypted, they're going to assist you in trying to negotiate that. It is rare that the full value of the ransom is paid when the insurance carriers are involved, because they do try and, believe it or not, they'll negotiate. They'll say, hey, you know, here, we'll give you this. Show us that you can really unencrypt this for us. Show us we're dealing with the right people. And in truth, the criminals love that because then they know they got a chance of getting some money out of you. Sometimes they'll walk away if they think they're going to get caught. But many times there'll be a dialogue. So it's not a clear cut. It becomes a business decision. We've seen in Florida, if you look at what's happened in Florida with some of their cities, you know, one city got hit. Within a couple weeks later, another city got hit. Once they realize that that group of the marketplace did not have protection, yes, they're going to go back and hit the well again. So as we talk about the insurance, I'll have more to say about that. But I'm sorry to interrupt, David. I did want to just add those notes.
No, not at all, but go ahead.
I was going to say, I talked with a cybersecurity expert recently, Dorothea, kind of to your point where it's not always, you know, the original demand. It was a small company and they, you know, they were communicating with the hacker who was demanding the ransom. They just told them, listen, we don't have the money to pay you. And the hacker eventually agreed to let them back into their system in exchange for photographic evidence that they had gone out and bought lunches for some of the homeless folks that were outside on the street. So it was this bizarre contrast of a guy who's a, you know, cyber criminal mastermind, but at the same time, he's doing the Robin Hood thing and making them buy food for the poor. So anyway, it's an interesting world out there. And David, we'll pivot back to you in a few of these more slides that we've got on the trend.
Oh, absolutely. And Ben, that's actually fascinating. And it just goes to show that, you know, the threat actors out there really can do whatever it is they want. And to Dorothea's point, yeah, absolutely. We rarely see an instance in which a ransomware attack was just that, right? It certainly can happen. There are certain, you know, referring to ransomware is kind of like calling a virus the flu, right? There are all different kinds, and the various threat actor groups are kind of like different gangs out there, right? Each one of them who develops their own, usually, you know, deploys their own products, you know, kind of like you deploy a computer program on your system, right? They sort of have their own proprietary way of doing it, their own techniques. And oftentimes, attackers will get into your network for, you know, days or months or years. And a really common trend that we've seen, if you look to there's a bullet here that says ransomware ruse, right, is that they'll engage in a whole bunch of activity for weeks or months, if not longer, before they deploy ransomware and encrypt everything sort of as a cherry on top of a really frustrating Sunday, I'll say. And some of those activities, right, involve deployment, a common trend now, of malware called banking trojans. And what they do is these banking trojans go onto your system. You know, you'll open an email, that looks familiar. It'll be a phishing email or something like that from somebody who you think you know and trust, and it'll have an attachment, and you'll open up what looks like a reasonable Word document that you'd ordinarily open, and it'll have a macro running in the background, and it'll contain a link to, or it'll automatically launch an executable for one of these banking trojans on your computer. And those are viruses that sit there and they operate in the background and you won't necessarily notice them. But what they do is they essentially raid your browsing cache. They raid your browsing history to pull out any passwords using an algorithm that you may have entered. Originally, they're called banking trojans because they were keyed towards looking for financial account credentials, right? So for anyone who entered online banking information in their web browser, they try to pull that down. But nevertheless, the usage has evolved to try and get access to email account credentials or to network account credentials, among other things, or they'll find a different way in to launch the same executable and rely upon that banking trojan, right, to get credentials, and the virus will move from machine to machine to machine until eventually they've got, you know, half the network compromised, which usually includes network access, email access, among other things. And they'll then, after they harvest as much data as they can, then at the end of their activity, deploy ransomware to you know, sort of realize that final bit of money that they can. And by bit of money, I mean whatever the ransom demand may be. It can be anywhere from, as Ben had mentioned, you know, sandwiches for the homeless on the street to we've seen one or two seven-figure ransom payments this year for large multinational companies who had mission-critical data encrypted. But as Darcia mentioned, we absolutely recommend negotiating down the ransom if it is within our client's business interest to pay. And we do so in reliance or in partnership with forensic investigation firms. They're digital experts, and what they do is they interface directly with the threat actors through anonymous accounts to present viable arguments that we collectively construct to say we can afford to pay X, or we don't have Bitcoin, but we can come up with a certain amount in a certain number of days, or our network is small, we only have one server, we can afford to pay something else. And anyway, there's a dialogue and an exchange to see if a reasonable solution can be reached. And more often than not, there is a decrease in the overall demand. And the threat actors model, we're sitting there going, well, do we want to pay bad guys to keep doing this? The answer is, again, it's a business decision. And oftentimes, what we need to remember about it is that to the bad guys, this is a business model, right? They're providing, and I don't mean to be cynical about it, but they are providing a service, right? They're saying, well, you pay us, we provide you with a decryption key, and that decryption key more often than not needs to generally work. It's never going to be rarely is absolutely perfect, but they do have a vested interest in making sure that the model is able to continue. So if you pay the demand, you're going to get a key. That key or tool is going to be more or less viable, and you're going to get the substantial majority of your data back in relatively short order. And sometimes they even, again, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but they do help you troubleshoot if you need it. So they want this model to continue. They want people to continue paying their demands. So I see a few questions here. What happens if you don't pay ransomware? Well, at the end of the day, very little. This to the threat actors is a business model. The unfortunate business reality is that a company that has no means to recover their data and refuses to pay the ransom may have no other, depending on a variety of circumstances, it's possible that you won't be able to get your data back. But if you have some data and you're concerned more about the risks, what's the risk reward? Do I pay these people? Do I not pay these people? Are they going to come after me if I don't do anything? At the end of the day, they're busy. They're moving on from target to target to target. And, the truth is they're not out for vengeance. They're not out to get you, really, they just want to get paid and move on. So if that answers that question, I think we can probably flip on to the next slide. I don't want to take too much more time since I know Ben and Dorothea have a lot to offer on the insurance side of things.
I'm just going to jump in quick, David, and give you a chance to catch your breath because you're doing an awesome job.
Thank you.
To hear more. But what I'd like to do now is just invite Ben Johnson from Cornerstone as a sponsor of today's webinar to say a few words. Ben?
Thanks, Mike. As you mentioned, since 1998, Cornerstone Support has served as a valued partner to more than 1,000 collection agencies, debt buyers, law firms, and credit grantors for their state licensing, funds, and commercial insurance needs. We welcome the opportunity to learn more about your organizations and see how we can assist you in developing and implementing a risk management strategy that can support your business goals and fit your budget. And by allowing us to take care of your licensing, bonds, and commercial insurance, you can focus your resources and energy on money-making ventures of your business. Whether you're new or established, national or regional in scope, Cornerstone offers an array of services and products that can support your licensing, bonds, and insurance needs. And for more information, of course, you can always visit our website at www.cornerstonesupport.com. And one thing that I did want to touch on here, and it's really, I can't necessarily answer the question for all of you, but I do want to at least ask the question and get you thinking about it. And Steve, I think we've got a slide in here somewhere, but the question, I don't feel like we're talking enough about the amount of records that we are collectively storing in the ARM industry, in the collection space, and how weighted down we are with that data. The folks that I talk to anecdotally, as you know, we field calls about cyber insurance quotes, and as I talk to folks at the different conferences, a lot of folks are hanging on to years and years worth of data, and there are various reasons for doing that, credit reporting disputes and other client requirements, of course. But the question is, can we look at more cold storage, unplugged options, even external hard drives, to get those accounts that are no longer being actively worked, but the ones that are a year old and 4 and 5 years old. And what I'm getting at is then in the event of a breach, you have a manageable number, a survivable number, if you will, of records, rather than a massive number of millions and millions of records, which could be obviously such a staggering cost that the business doesn't survive. And so that's the question I wanted to get people thinking about. And there's not an easy answer to it, I understand, with various collection software out there. But it's something, if nothing else, to maybe chat with your IT folks about. Can we partition? Can we segregate? I want to get to Dorothea and some of the insurance pieces. So, Dorothea, I can maybe throw it to you, and if you've got any thoughts on that vein. And if not, we can jump right into notification costs and some of those coverage provisions in a cyber liability insurance policy.
So I do have some thoughts. Wherever you can siphon that information off and put it in what they call dead storage in a server that's not connected to the internet, that's no longer utilized by your internal group, that is held but not accessible, you are limiting that data from being taken or misused. So we see banks that do this. They keep banking records for a significantly long period of time, but they will pull that data, anything that's 18 months or 12 months out of date, they will purge that data from their system, put it in a separate storage system that is either on-site or with their cloud provider, but in an area that is not accessible via the internet. And that is one of the risk management techniques that you can use to protect yourself. It is not always feasible, but it certainly can take 1 million records down to 500,000 records in many cases, and just make it so there's less notification, there's less credit monitoring, there's less breach services that need to be provided, because you can document that these users were not affected or these records were not affected. And we'll see more of that. I think there'll be more solutions as we go forward, especially because of the healthcare industry is also trying to do this. I'm sorry to interrupt somebody who's trying to chime in.
Oh, no, Dorothea, that's a great point. Just to quickly build on that in terms of offering a few just low-hanging fruit suggestions. You know, again, even for those of you out there who are using Office 365, for instance, depending on your enterprise-level package, you can often set a record retention period of, say, 60 or 90 days, right? You don't, just because, you know, you have a variety of statutory or contractual retention obligations doesn't mean that you can't, that you need to keep those emails containing sensitive data in your, you know, in your inbox. You can use a bank-safe archiving solution or follow any of the suggestions that Dorothea just offered to store that information in a more secure fashion. And, you know, in the unlikely event, I hope it never happens, of an email compromise, for instance, you know, you're looking at, you know, 80% less data that the attackers could theoretically access. That could cause your notification costs to, you know, greatly diminish if in the event of a notification.
Great, and now we'll move forward to the insurance slides and get Dorothea to kind of delve into some of the specifics here of when you're buying this coverage, what are you paying for?
Well, that's a really good question, and some customers even ask that question. The first thing I want to say is that none of these policies are alike. Some of them even use the same term, but the term means something different. A good example of this is the term crisis management. Crisis management to one company will mean strictly PR relations for if you have something go wrong with your business. Crisis management to another company can mean everything. It means the breach response, it means the notification, it means everything. So it is important to understand that the terms are different. So be aware that just hearing the terms that you're hearing today from your insurance person, ask them to tell you what that means. And it doesn't matter who that professional is. The next slide that we're bringing up here is a kind of a look at a policy, what you should be looking for. And it is a traditional flow of how most of the privacy network security policies go. The first thing you'll see is privacy and security. Those two go together because if they break into your system, it's about what information they get. Then if they've taken information, you have to respond to it, and that's the breach response. That's meeting the state guidelines. Some states are 20 days, some states are 90 days, some states are 120 days. You have to know which each state information that you have to meet. And the record count, some states it's 100 records, some states it's 1,000 records before you have to notify. And then there are different means of which you can notify, whether it be via an online posting on your website that you were breached, which I would never want any customer of mine to ever do, because then that sits there and it's public knowledge for everybody. Or if it's an email, or in some cases a phone call and an email, or strictly a written notification via the regular U.S. Postal Service. Regulatory is what happens if you don't do your breach response in a timely manner. There are fines and penalties that accrue from the state. And it is usually a state regulatory issue, although if you have healthcare records, it could be HIPAA, HITECH, or any of the government agencies regulating health records.
Dorothea, while we've got this slide up, I was going to throw in, you know, one common question that we see from collection agents is, well, I've got a cyber add-on or endorsement that is tacked onto my existing general liability coverage or my errors and omissions policy. What would that likely be missing that we're seeing right here on this slide, as opposed to a standalone separate cyber liability policy?
So, I'm sorry, can you repeat that one more time?
Basically, just when I've got an add-on or an endorsement on an E&O policy, for example, and it looks like a big number, it says $1 million or it says $5 million, whatever it says, but it's not really including all 8 or 9 of these coverage points that we've got here. One of those, of course,
so
being
traditionally speaking, yes, traditionally speaking, they will include the privacy, they might include the regulatory, they rarely include the cybercrime, the business interruption, or the PCI, or the media coverage. And certainly, not many of you on this call will need the technology, you know, but if you were in the technology industry, if you were licensing out software, that is something that you would need. So from the perspective of whenever you purchase an add-on to a coverage that you're really purchasing, the coverage that you're really purchasing is where they put the meat of what you're going to get protected on. If it's an endorsement, it's meant to give you what we call supplemental coverage. Some coverage, but not all coverage. Unless the policy is intended for that purpose, rarely does it give you all of the coverage portions. And the biggest coverage portion that's missing from that, traditionally speaking, is the cyber crime, which, as David said earlier, our criminals are getting significantly more sophisticated with, and the cyber crime is actually changing. We have this new terminology called invoice manipulation, where somebody believes that they're sending it to the right person and they're not, and they say, okay, well, I paid, I'm done, I don't have to pay you now because I can show that the email came from your server, or it looked enough like your server that I had no means of telling that it wasn't. That's called invoice manipulation. And it used to be that the onus was on them to still pay you. It is not necessarily that way today. So that is a brand new coverage that wasn't even available before January of this past year. So, and who knows what we'll need by the end of this year. As David spoke about bricking coverage, bricking is a specific incident where a computer becomes like a brick. We've seen that happen with large cranes. We've seen it happen with MRI machines in hospitals. We've seen it happen with entire systems. And for better or for worse, the particular industry that we're talking to today is not the most loved industry. There's a thing called cyber hacktivism and terrorism, and it is strictly slated against individual communities. They're now bringing up the slide for cost. These are average costs for what it costs consumers to fix their cyber problems. The first one is the breach cost, and that is to be able to respond with notification. Crisis services, that is things that you need immediately. It can include forensics, it can include PR, it can include a lot of different things. Then there's large company breaches, something similar to what you see with, you know, like a Target or an Office Depot. This is just the cost for the breach, not any of the lawsuits that come out of it. And then business interruption. Business interruption, if they shut your business down, how much profit would you lose on that given day? And multiply it by the number of days that they have you shut down. And that is your business interruption cost.
Just to briefly jump in.
Pretty large. Sorry, David.
No, I was going to say those are all incredible points. Just to quickly build on a little bit on Ben's question of, well, what about those endorsements to CGL policies? You know, if you look right now at the side and the crisis service costs with an average of $307,000, many, not all the time, but many times those commercial general liability endorsements for limited first party cyber coverage come with sublimits, right? So even though it looks like there's $1 million of coverage, really there's a $5,000 sublimit for forensic investigation services and legal services, or $10,000 or $15,000. But as you can see, when you look at those numbers, you know, that's like throwing a pebble into Lake Erie. You know, it's not going to do the trick. So it's really, I can't stress strongly enough how important it is to work with not just a trusted broker, but a broker who knows cyber, someone like Dorothea, who can really make sure you understand exactly what it is that you're purchasing and ensure that you're appropriately covering the risks that you project.
And David, I would agree with that last statement, especially making sure they can help you to understand what your risks are and how the policy will respond. It is very important. Each of these policies, be it an endorsement, be it a separate form, all respond differently, and understanding that response is huge, because you don't want to think you have coverage and it not be there for you when you need it. And particularly the notification, many of the policies, and we don't have this on here, it's really for later in the conversation. When you have a claim, you need to get on the phone with the carrier immediately. Most of them require that you tell them within 24 hours of finding out about the incident so that they can help you to respond, because that's going to give you the greatest control of stopping the problem from evolving. And you should not, if you have insurance coverage, you need to look at, can I handle this myself? Can I use my current IT professionals, or do I need to use the carrier's IT professionals to come and figure out what's wrong? Oftentimes people want to use their own IT professionals. I will tell you, as an insurance professional who's seen probably 250 claims at this point, I've been doing this for quite some time now, don't. You can be tempted to want to work with your current IT people, but they can't see their own flaws. You need that outside resource, whether it be the insurance company's forensic group or whether it be a forensic group you pick from a panel, but you need somebody different than the person who's worked with it day in, day out, because they can't see the problems that they might have helped create. So that's my biggest piece of advice today. If you hear anything else, is if you have a problem, get outside help to fix it. And the proof of the pudding of that is the Home Depot claim here in Atlanta. They thought that they had everything under control. They didn't. It ended up costing their company six times what it would have cost them had they used an outside firm to investigate and determine the cause of loss. So please, big or small, don't risk it. Have somebody from the outside look at it. With breach notification, we touched on this a little bit, and David touched on it as well. It really is individual state rules. So if you're a multi-state company and you have users or client data or patient history from various states, you have to comply with those states' rules. Who to notify, when to notify, and how to notify. If you don't hit all those time frames, you're going to get fines from each one of those states. And they will fine you for every person that you had in that state, whether they were affected or not. So it is critical to have somebody to organize a group, be it like David's or be it with your current carrier, who can organize that for you and make sure that the notifications happen in a proper and timely manner so that you don't accrue fines and penalties. Can we move on to the next slide? Because that's pretty much for the breach response, what we need to touch on. Credit monitoring. Credit monitoring is up to 2 years in some states required. So it's important to have a plan for that, be that with your carrier, or be that on your own. You need to have a plan for how you're going to handle the credit monitoring. In addition to that, you know, credit monitoring costs can escalate. The average cost of credit monitoring is $10 per affected customers. So that number can be huge as it grows. But many of the insurance companies, they pool their resources together. So in some cases, the credit monitoring, you don't even get a charge for it. We were talking earlier today, Beasley does all their credit monitoring outside. They pay a fee to the credit monitoring bureaus to just always take care of it when they have a problem. So credit monitoring is a great benefit of the insurance policies. Move forward. So the Phenom Institute, for those of you who really get excited about IT, the Phenom Institute puts out some amazing data. It's run by IBM, and it looks at different types of servers, different types of workstations, different groups from all over the country to develop and pull the information on what happens when there's an IT issue. And they give you the cost typically for forensics is $20,000 to $50,000. That's when that outside IT person comes in and helps you to figure out what happened. That is critical to determine. If you don't determine how it happened, I can promise you it will happen again. The most notable example of this, and David, I don't know if you are familiar with it or not, but is Sony Game Systems. Sony Game Systems was the number one gaming company in the entire world. They got hit. No problem. They stayed number one. They got hit again in 6 months. They became number three. They got hit again and hit again and hit again, and now they are one of the pack. And users remember, if you're constantly being told that your company that you're working with, that the data has been hit, users remember that, and they don't utilize those services again. So it has a lasting impact on the reputation of the companies who are hit.
Oh, absolutely. Just to build on that, absolutely. And the forensics firms also, you know, it's kind of like the equivalent of if you have a good in-house IT guy, and I completely and totally agree with Dorothea's point. You know, if you have a great, just because you have a great IT firm, which is kind of like a great general practitioner for a doctor, doesn't mean that they're qualified to, you know, conduct really specialist oriented work, right? The forensics firms are absolute experts. They're kind of like Harvard-trained, brain surgeons at what they do and tracing attackers' movements through networks to figure out how they got in and close up those vulnerabilities so that we don't become the next, as, you know, to build on the analogy that Dorothea mentioned, to not be a repeat target, to not have that business risk. And also they, you know, are often able to tell you whether or not the attacker actually opened files just because they were in your network. Doesn't mean that they were accessing personal information, things like names plus socials, names plus credit, you know, financial account numbers, means to access all that information that would trigger a notification obligation. The forensics can often tell you that even though the bad guys were in your network, whether they did or didn't actually touch individual files during those periods of access that would trigger an obligation. So there's an additional tremendous value add, right? You can sometimes get around notification by bringing in the right people at the right time early on.
Okay. So moving on, if we can move on to the next slide, because I think we've already talked about the credit monitoring, cybercrime. This is something that David spent a good amount of time on. And to add to his discussion, I can't discuss enough about spear phishing. Spear phishing is when they target a specific individual, oftentimes the controller of the company, the HR person, as David was talking about earlier, where they convince that person that it's another member of the company that has that right to ask for this information, and it's forwarded. It is successful more often than anybody would like to admit. And they do the research by looking online. If you have information about your company in LinkedIn, in Facebook, any of those areas, hackers have the same ability to go on the internet that you do. They Google in the names that they find for your company, they Google in your company, and they find as much information as they can and make their attacks look as viable and real as possible. Oftentimes, the only clue that it might not have been real, because the email will look the same, the signature will be the same because they will have sent a test email to the individual and gotten what their signature looks like, will be a phrasing that person might not have ever used, and that might be the only signal in the email that was wrong. So this has become very popular in the banking industry and in the financial industry, because getting information and getting in and getting money out quickly is what they're looking for. They're looking for a quick attack. Can we move on to the next slide? So business interruption, we touched on this earlier. I can't emphasize enough, business interruption for privacy and network security claims where data is breached is primarily only found on a cyber privacy and network security policy. It is often not found on those add-on policy or add-on endorsements to either the GL or to the E&O. The business interruption, if your system goes down, it can be quite expensive. I've got some very high price claims examples here with Delta. There's in addition to if somebody has broken into your system, there's a thing called system failure, which is essentially where your cabinet fails. If you have a server cabinet and you're storing all of your information on it and it fails, much like what happened with Delta. Delta on a Sunday night, an engineer put a wrench down on top of a cabinet in Atlanta, and that wrench demagnetized the server, which dropped Delta's entire system because that one server had a dependent link to all the other servers. They had to figure out which server it was that got dropped because all of a sudden everything went away. It wasn't a gradual, it was an immediate. And then they had to restore that server and then have the relationships reconnected before Delta could be back up and running again properly. That can happen with records. The records that you're using to make collections, if you lose that database, how can your team work? Do you have a backup for handling that? Do you have a way of getting it back? All of that takes time, and your business will be interrupted, and it will affect. It's like a fire. Many businesses go out of business within 2 years of a fire, not because of the fire itself, but because of the fallout from trying to get everything back up and running properly. Network asset protection leads right into that. These are the expenses on how to get your data back up and running. And the claims example here is very realistic for a mid to average size company. You're going to spend a lot of your money on the forensics, on making sure that you know exactly how you went down and that you brought yourself back up at the exact moment that you lost information. So it is very important to understand how your company will need to get back up and running. The next for me is third-party exposure. So all of the claim examples that we've been talking about thus far from the insurance perspective have been things that are going to affect you and your company. But you hold data that belongs either to other individuals or that is utilized by other individuals, and they can have loss due to that data being compromised. So these are what we call third-party exposures, meaning you're not injured, your employees aren't injured, but somebody else is injured. There can be contingent bodily damage. If you injure somebody's credit and they can't have medical services provided to them because they weren't able to financially or appear to financially be able to pay for them. You can have PCI fines and penalties if the credit card companies deem that you're the cause of a breach or a leak. You can have class action lawsuits for mental anguish and emotional distress because you were negligent in the way that you handled the data of these individuals. You can have libel, slander, and defamation claims because of your website, social media, and print ads and intellectual property. Many of these things are not included on those add-on endorsements. They're only included when you purchase the policy that covers first and third party exposures.
And just to build on that as well quickly, you know, in addition, if you're sitting there going, those claims are silly, there's no merit to them, I'm going to go to court and win. On average, for us, just to get to the motion stage, right, to win on summary judgment, to set forth those arguments after developing evidence, the cost can exceed $250,000 easily, if not $500,000. So it's that coverage is critical.
I heard from one cyber expert recently that there are estimates that globally within 3 years, cyber liability losses will exceed the dollar amount of the international drug trade. So that's kind of a chilling thought to end on as we kind of run out of time here. Mike, again, thanks for having us. Did you have any last questions or need anything from Sophia or David?
I didn't, but what usually the way I like to wrap these events up is to give everybody, you know, maybe you, Dorothea, and Ben a chance to share any other sort of key takeaways or any concluding remarks or maybe anything you didn't get a chance to talk about but wanted to because you thought it was important, but just the sort of any parting words of wisdom for those who are listening and for those who are going to now and for those who will be listening to the recording later. Maybe we can start with you, Ben. And I know there was a key point that you made earlier that maybe you want to reiterate on, you know, what you hope people walk away from this event with today.
Sure. Again, thanks for tuning in, and thanks to David and Dorothea. One takeaway, I just think that as an industry, we need to talk more about archiving and unplugging those consumer files that are going back 4, 5, 6, 7 years that you're storing. and maybe talk with your software provider, talk with your own IT folks, and figure out what's the best strategy to reduce your exposure there. David, I'll let you throw in a concluding remark, and then Dorothea.
Sure. Just to build on that quickly, again, getting back to hitting some of those low-hanging fruit targets, right? If we are, you know, the goal is to remain as aware as we can of suspicious activity, ask questions if you're unsure, if you can use a multi-factor authentication solution to protect your email or your network credentials. That's basically something like, you know, a text in addition to entering your password, you'd have to, you know, have text with four numbers set to your phone and you hit accept or something like that, you know. Use that extra factor to protect your network. Again, be aware, reduce your data footprint, and overall educate your team and your employees about the risks that are out there. And taking those small steps can go a long way towards reducing your overall cyber exposure.
Thanks, David. Dorothea? Yep, go ahead. Yep.
Yeah. So I think the one thing that I would say is, as having previously been a business owner, and just now being part of a large company, it's when I look at what myself as a business owner wanted to know was, am I personally protected? Is my company going to survive this? Those are the two, for me, the two real big questions that you have to answer. And the way to answer them is, one, do I have something that can protect me, i.e. potentially an insurance policy or some form of risk transfer with an IT group? And two, do I understand what it's going to do for me? And do I understand the areas of exposure that I have? And that means talking to your IT professionals and asking them questions that they might give you some pushback on because you're asking, but you need to know. You need to know what can happen to my business if I don't protect this, and how am I protected? And then insuring it properly.
Of course. Well, excellent. Well, Ben, Dorothea, David, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. Really appreciate the comprehensiveness of the information that you shared. Also want to thank Ben and the team at Cornerstone Support again for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate their participation. Please go to www.cornerstonesupport.com to learn more about the company. Thanks everybody who participated. A final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey when you get a chance. And I hope everyone stays tuned to AccountsRecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. A recording of today's event will be posted to the site's webinar recordings page later today. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great day.